I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source in the buzzing arts colony of higher education in Boston with Lee Pelton, the president of Emerson College, which has re-inhabited the theaters and lit up the nightlife downtown where the X-rated combat zone used to be, and Roger Brown, president of the Berklee College of Music with 4,000 undergraduates, now the biggest contemporary music school in the world, stretching out towards Spain and China, as Lee Pelton's Emerson opens a branch in the heart of Hollywood. This is a part of a continuing open source conversation about higher education, for richer or poorer, in America. This hour is about heady times, especially in Boston's old bohemian quarter of the education capital. But there are issues too, when the students start telling you about their debt loads and the job market. On what they call Berklee Beach, the sidewalk outside the shiny new dormitory on Massachusetts Avenue by the Turnpike. Also at Emerson commencement last week, this was some of the student chatter about hopes and dreams and fears.
You know, I'd like to graduate from Berklee, definitely. I know a lot of people don't end up graduating from here, so that would be a big accomplishment. Then I think I'd like to move to London and try to get in on the music scene there.
People don't pursue music initially because of the money. You'll never hear somebody say, I'm in a touring band because I make 300K a year.
I think what it comes down to is doing something that you're truly passionate about. And I couldn't see myself going to work every day and sitting in a teeny little office doing that. Music is what I care about, and it's what I really want to do with my life.
Broadway is a goal. It's not a dream anymore, it's a goal. And so I'm really excited to just pursue it, and I'm excited for the journey.
So I studied professional music, specializing in songwriting and performance. I'm a fiddle player. I'm moving back to Nashville, Tennessee, where I grew up, to work for some country music musicians playing fiddle and mandolin.
I currently live and work in Los Angeles, California, as a post-production assistant for a reality television company. They do a lot of popular reality series. I currently work on The Great Food Truck Race and Kim of Queens.
I don't have like a job after September, so $281 a month is going to be kind of hard to come by.
I was lucky they gave me financial aid, but regardless of that, it's still you still have a lot of debt no matter what. I feel okay now because I'm walking and this is a happy occasion, but give me 2 weeks and it's going to be horrible. Yes, it's crushing, but today's a good day. Go hour by hour, not month by month.
What is an art school renaissance worth to the city, to aspiring artists? Join the conversation, please, at 800-423-8255. Lee Pelton and Roger Brown, isn't it time to reintroduce these places? Emerson first, a school of oratory when it opened in 1880. Then it became a school for actors and writers. And Berklee, called Schillinger House on Newbury Street when the Burke family started it in 1945. It was the school of post-war jazz by the time young Quincy Jones arrived in 1951. Gary Burton, the four-mallet vibraphone wizard, arrived from Indiana as a student in 1960. Branford Marsalis from New Orleans in the late 70s. And then yesterday, some sort of synergy happened, or alchemy, and digital media too, and a takeoff. We're in a new world. Roger, you start. How did we get here?
Well, I think we got here because technology has changed modern life in dramatic ways. And I think creativity and innovation are the new tools and skills that young people need. And I think arts education, music education, puts them at the intersection of technology and creativity. And I think it can create huge opportunities for them. Of course, they're taking enormous risks, because the path they're on is not well-defined, and they're not employers waiting to give them jobs the day they walk out the door.
Lee Pelton, how did Emerson get here? I mean, to this moment.
Well, a great question. I mean, as you know, Emerson at one point was located in the Back Bay on Beacon Street, and my predecessor and an inspired board had the great idea to move it from the Back Bay to the Theater District. Increased its square footage, doubled the square footage from about 500,000 square feet to over 1 million square feet, doubled the student population, revitalized in a very significant, important way part of the downtown that needed revitalization.
It's not dingy anymore.
No, it's not dingy anymore.
Fewer jobs for our musicians, I have to say.
And, you know, it's the shining example of the impact of the creative economy. Emerson is not a liberal arts college in the traditional sense, and it's not a pre-professional school in the traditional sense. And liberal arts colleges are looking for relevance, and professional schools are looking for ways to embed liberal learning into their curriculum. And so we have taken elements of both and created mm-hmm. something new. So we really are we are truly unique in higher education.
There are numbers that we got to talk about, and they're scary. But I just want to testify first that there's a vibe around both of these places. And we got to acknowledge it. I live downtown. I feel it every day. There's energy, this incredible diversity of the species from all over the world. We've called on some of your students from time to time for special things. They can all do everything digitally, and they cross each other coming and going. Maybe there's a vibe about schools of art in which part of the gift is the permission to fail, mm-hmm. to experiment. At both of your schools, it's been impractical from the beginning to expect practical results. Helen Vendler, your friend Lee, dug up a line on learning from the poet John Ashbery, who said, "I tried each thing, only some were immortal and free. Only some became poetry or art." Isn't that the real underlying pleasure of your institutions?
Well, I think the ethos of Berkeley was the first school to teach jazz, and jazz is built on improvisation and risk-taking and creation in the moment. So we try to keep that alive in what our students care about and what they study and how they work. And I think the stakes are higher because the opportunities are greater with this infusion of technology into everything we do. But as you said, college education is expensive. It takes a while to get a degree. And we have a moral obligation to give our students the finest education we can and give them the best shot. At the young woman, I could hear the voices of our students. You know, the dream is to be able to do the thing you love every day. And if you love music, to be able to make a life doing music as a profession is just a fantastic dream come true if you can make it happen.
I know enough of your faculty in both institutions to know that that spirit really imbues mm-hmm. a lot of older folk, too. Let me just also note that something's happening here for the city that a lot of other American cities, I mean, leave out Los Angeles and New York perhaps, but would kill for. And it's something very old around Boston. In 1900, people spoke of having an avenue of the arts where Huntington Avenue is now, but it was going to go, imagine, from the Public Garden and the Music Hall and the Public Library and Symphony Hall, Jordan Hall, New England Conservatory, eventually the Boston Conservatory, including the Museum of Fine Arts, include, if you want, Fenway Park. I mean, it's only a long home run away. But something grander even than Lincoln Center. And suddenly, it's there, almost. In bloom, and it begins to feel like the core of the town.
I think we're lucky. I do think Berkeley is a unique institution. Emerson is as well, and Lee and I have been trying to dream up lots of new ways we can collaborate to help students from both of our institutions. But you have NEC and Boston Conservatory, and BU has a fine music school, and there's a lot of music happening in some of the more traditional schools. You have a huge group of young people experimenting with social media and all these new tools at their fingertips, and I think we have the opportunity to be a mecca for young creative people as a city. I'm excited that the new mayor seems to embrace that idea, and we're dreaming up ways to encourage those young artists to make a life here in Boston if that's the destiny that they find themselves.
Lee Pelton, do you feel yourself part of a sort of a swarm?
I do, and the swarm is not only the so-called art schools, but it's urban colleges in Boston. There has been a real renaissance, a real explosion and growth among those universities. So not only the ones that, that Roger mentioned, but if you think of Northeastern today as opposed to Northeastern 20 years ago, and the schools in the Fenway, which now
Simmons, Emmanuel,
yeah, exactly, and they've all been wonderful schools, but today I think even more so and even more prominent. And so I think Emerson and Berkeley are part of this renaissance of just really great close-in urban colleges and universities.
Roger, I'm glad you mentioned the mayor. I have a sense that he knows this, but I'm also wondering, are you getting what you need from the city?
Well, I told the mayor that he was the only candidate to show up at the Berkeley Beantown Jazz Festival, and lo and behold, he won. So he should learn a lesson from
John
that.
John Conley, in fairness, had an arts agenda too. But what is Marty Walsh's?
Well, I think the idea of making Boston a hipper, cooler city, open later, allowing more venues where music can be heard, where students and young people can hang out and meet each other, a place with more incubators and places where you can get businesses started. Those are all important ideas. And, you know, the artists have always been the first to colonize new parts of a city and create excitement and buzz. So,
what about giving you more dormitory space, if I get very particular? Partly because we're coming to realize that freelance students coming from anywhere in institutions that don't have dormitories, including all the graduate schools, are driving people into the hands of cutthroat real estate owners, and also they're driving working-class folk out of three-deckers.
Well, I think we have to give Mayor Menino credit for that agenda. He quickly saw that the fastest way to create affordable housing was to get me and Lee to build it, get our students out of apartments, and make the city safer and create more housing for residents. And so our new building, the 160 Mass Ave building, is predominantly a dormitory for 370 students. And we think it'll make us a better campus. We can now house all of our entering students, which we've never been able to do before. But I definitely think dormitory housing is part of how you create a community, especially in an urban campus.
We're talking about two venerable Boston institutions, the Berklee College of Music and Emerson College.
5, 4, 3.
Camera 3,
two,
Plasmas.
1.
From Emerson's leading
ready,
news
camera 2
team.
With the latest push.
World news at our nation's top story.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the higher education capital of the world, we're learning what we can from the presidents of two pre-professional art schools spreading up and out as far as China. Berklee for all kinds of music, Emerson for acting and more. For the perspective of experience and solid accomplishment, we ask two pros in the middle of enviable careers what they learned in and out of school, where they would look for college, how much they'd pay if they were starting out again. Chris Cooper is a Hollywood hero in supporting roles. He won an Academy Award for one of them in Spike Jonze's adaptation. His wife, Marianne Leone, played the gangster mama Joanne Moltisanti in The Sopranos on HBO. They spoke with us at home, just south of Boston.
I had a simple state school, went to the University of Missouri, and I think I got serious about the business of acting in my second semester year of my sophomore year. But before that, I was constantly in the theater, offering my services at all times, any time of the day, just trying to fill myself up with the whole atmosphere of not just acting, but the whole process of mounting a stage play.
I went to a state school too, and I had no debt when I left because I paid my own way through. I went to UMass Boston, and I did major in theater, even though we had a really nascent, theater department then. It was just at the beginning. We had this stage where if you exited stage left, you had to stay at stage left for the rest of the entire play, and it was basic, shall we say. I honestly feel that I didn't really get my true education as an actor until I got to New York and I studied with Wynn Hanman, who was from the Neighborhood Playhouse. That's when I really got training.
What are kids getting in the professional art schools today? How does school prepare them for that world?
I would say I don't think it does. I would have liked somebody to come in and say, this is how you join a union, that you're not going to work until you're in the union, and this is how you get in the union. Nobody prepared us for that. I mean, these are practical applications. These are things about survival. Also, the idea of a survival job. I know that everybody expects instant gratification, but there's often years of, you know, working at some job that you really don't want to be working at. So what are you going to do? What's your survival job? In Chris's case, master carpenter. In my case, I use the fact that I knew how to write. So I wrote copy for video.
A student beginning in acting is going to really have to face a lot of rejection day to day. That's part of the business. You know, be prepared for it.
Chris Cooper, you're an Oscar winner. You're a famous face in many movies. When you walk through an airport and people come up and say, I want to do what you do, what do you tell them?
Well, I look at their shoulders and I say, you probably recognize me from film. What you don't know is that I did 15 years of theater before film. And their question is, well, yes, I want to do what you do. How do you do it? But when I say that 15 years of theater, I see their shoulders drop. And what's not being said is, it took you that long before you got, you know, in quotes, recognition. I think there's an instant gratification that, you know, people imagine happens with this business. I mean, it doesn't. You can do all the training, you can do all those exercises, you can work your butt off, but it comes down to the moment of action. And can you deliver at that moment? That's what it comes down to. I make no bones about it. I run on fear. I run on fear of failure. After they say, you know, action and cut, I don't want to have any regrets. I want to give the best performance I possibly can.
How would you advise a high school kid about the choice of a college to do the kinds of things you do?
Oh, for our thing, I would say go to a state school for your undergraduate. I mean, if you're from a working class family, if you're not from an ultra rich family that can write you a check for your education, don't take on enormous debt. You're going to be taking on some debt anyway if you're choosing the arts. You know, the word every parent longs to not hear. I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be a writer. I don't think it's what they really want to hear.
Those were the actors Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper. You can hear a longer excerpt of that interview on our website, radioopensource.org. Roger Brown of Berklee College, Lee Pelton of Emerson. I want to hear you talk about what art schools actually teach these days. I keep wondering, have you improved on the cop's answer, practice, 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 when the kid asked, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? How are you doing it differently these days?
Well, I think the... Go ahead, Lee.
No, it's, you know, I humorously describe Emerson as MIT for the other side of the brain. And by that, what I mean is that the students who come to us are, they know what they want to do. Just as they know they want to be an actor, they know they want to be in marketing communications or whatever it might be, just as a student who goes to MIT knows that she wants to be an architect or he wants to be a civil engineer or whatever it is. We have 7 departments, not 50. And so students come to us with enormous passion. And our job is really pretty simple, and that is to educate them so they become the persons that they were meant to be. And that is what we do. And we do it inside the classroom and outside of the classroom.
How do you prepare for that moment Chris Cooper was speaking about when they say action?
Well, we prepare them because part of our curriculum is the liberal arts, so that they can be nimble and flexible. You know, we just did a survey of students who graduated from the class of 2013 at Emerson. We did the survey in November. 9 out of 10 said that they had a job in November, and 8 out of 10 said they had a job in their field. And so it is possible. It is really very possible.
But for something in the neighborhood of 25,000, right? I mean, we're going to have to get to these money issues.
Well, yes, but obviously money is not the only source of happiness and satisfaction for a long life. You know, as Plato says, you want to not only be not only want to be fit company for others, but you want to be fit company for yourself as well. And so how do you put a value on personal growth?
It can't be done, but I mean, you heard what the students said to us, and you must hear it all the time. $50,000 every year to go through school, a lot of kids with $50,000 debt loads. Artists, in other words, starting out with $1,000 a month forever on their backs for the dear old school, before the car, before the rent, before the kids. One kid said to me on the beach there, he's $300,000 in the hole to Wells Fargo. But not to worry, he said he's going to win a Grammy. But let's be real, Roger?
Well, if he has $300,000 of debt, he borrowed $100,000 more than it took to pay for everything we charge. So, you know, here's my point of view. The single biggest challenge we face at Berkeley, and I think most private higher education institutions face, is what we do is fantastic, but it's expensive. And we can lighten the load by financial aid and scholarship support, and we have quadrupled the amount of scholarship support we offer in the last decade.
It wasn't big a decade ago.
Pardon?
It wasn't much.
It wasn't big. It was $9 million then, and it's $40 million now. And it really should be $80 million if we were doing what we'd like to do. But, you know, I don't think we can engineer our way out of this jam with incremental changes. You know, back to what Mary Ann said, you know, I think a lot of students would be better off in a community college for a year or two and then articulate and transfer to Berkeley. And we have relationships with six Canadian and U.S. community colleges to let them do that. So they can live at home, they can spend less money on tuition, transfer all those credits to Berkeley. We have 19 international schools we work with, from Kuala Lumpur to Tel Aviv to Seoul, where you can do the same thing at much less cost. And would that student rather be in Boston on the Berkeley campus? Absolutely.
They'd rather be away from home, sure, but that's an interesting idea. Let them test their medals, discover whether they've got something to say.
And if they don't have it, then better find out before they move to Boston and go into debt. And one thing I'll say to our faculty who say, wouldn't it be better if they were here 4 years? Yes. But if they come for 2 years and drop out and they have debt and no degree, that's sort of the worst of all worlds. So I think these articulation agreements are important, and we're doing more with online education, as you know. We got 12,000 students studying music online with us now. And the tuition for that is 60% less than it is on the physical campus, because you don't get a physical campus. You don't get practice rooms. You don't get student activities. You don't get a counseling center. But, you know, I think there's some ways we can radically re-engineer higher education, make it more affordable, take some debt out of the system, both for students and for the institution. So I think in some ways our biggest challenge is also our biggest opportunity.
I want to push back on that. It sounds like a far-out idea, but it seems to me perverse in a way that the schools, and not just you guys, put the debt burden precisely on those brave, young, teenage souls who are volunteering to reimagine our world and think anew for all of us. I mean, there's a sort of pretense that Harvard served us up Wallace Stevens or Yo-Yo Ma or Matt Damon. In fact, it's the Yo-Yo Ma's and the Matt Damon's who have added glory to the name of Harvard. Why shouldn't the institutions pay the enormously talented kids?
Well, we do.
We do, and I think you need to disaggregate, this debt issue. There's a $1 trillion worth of student debt out there. It is a lot, but there is a difference between the published price and the actual cost of attendance. And if you look, for instance, at the not-for-profit schools in the Commonwealth over the last 4 years, the actual net price, the cost of attendance, has actually decreased by about 4% during that time, because colleges have made an enormous investment in financial aid.
Some no. I mean, the marvel is, Thomas Frank said last week on this program that we're looking at hedge funds that happen to own a university in a place like Harvard, and they're still $32 billion in their kitty, and they're still charging young kids who've got all they can do to write that poem or dream the music.
Yeah, but Harvard has a very robust, financial aid.
Harvard's
program.
Problem is not financial aid for those who need it. It's that their admissions requirements make it difficult for low-income kids to get in.
At Berkeley, we kind of have the opposite problem. We're looking for great musicians, and there are a lot of low-income kids who can really play well. So we have a lot of people who want to come who don't have the means. We want to support them. We now have about 200 students on full scholarships, but some of them are so poor they still have to borrow money, even with a full scholarship.
How many full scholarships did Emerson be?
I don't know that number. We do discount our tuition. You know, the average debt load among students, the average. So I know this doesn't, you know, there are those at the extremes, obviously, but is about $24,000. It's the price of a nice automobile, and the for-profit, the students at for-profit colleges who account for 10% of students account for half of the defaults, and the debt load that they carry is 50% higher. It's right around $36,000 a year.
23 might get you a used Subaru. And I got to tell you, I've given up my car. I don't want the car anymore. I'm Zipcar for the rest of the way. Right. That doesn't persuade me. Averages may be deceptive, but also, I mean, go to a fancy restaurant. There are kids in there who are 100, 200, sometimes more in debt. These are crippling, crippling loads, and they're the best people we have.
Well, Chris, I think one of the things that we have to go back to is private higher education, with the exception of the really, really wealthy schools, cannot make it possible for every deserving young person to be educated there. So that's why I think interesting combinations of state universities. University of Lowell has a very, very good music program. Right. It might be a good idea for a student to spend 2 years there and then re-audition to Berkeley and come when they've progressed in their musical career and they're still committed to the place. So, you know, I guess in an ideal world, I'd love to be able to educate and train every single deserving student, but we're actually discouraging students from coming if they don't have the means to make it through, and we can't give them enough support to make it through. And trying to find alternative pathways through online, through community colleges, through these international partner schools.
Listen, I'm for a debt amnesty for all students and all student debt, trillion or whatever it is. But I don't mean to beat you up about it. And maybe we should move on, because I want to acknowledge that both of your schools do extraordinary things. I've seen Berkeley kids working with young trumpet players at Boston Latin School, for example. I mean, they're doing their part, as citizens. But I'd love to hear you just talk about what these kids do. 4,000 Berkeley musicians from all over the world, acting, interacting, making combinations, as yours do, Lee Pelton, and they've got all sorts of other institutions, BU and theater and New England Conservatory down the street, if they want more variety. Talk about the combinations that you guys are making, intellectually, internationally, in terms of different media.
Yeah. Well, one of our hypotheses, and Lee and I have discussed this at length, is it's obvious that media is converging. Young people rarely listen to music without seeing some imagery with it. When they go to YouTube, they're listening to music, but they expect high-quality video. And the new means of music discovery is not you play in a club and a label hears you and signs you. It's you post a YouTube video and 400,000 people watch it and a label calls you and says, wow, I really like that. So the musician needs the videographer. And the videographer, if they're going to make a film, has got to have great music. So the convergence of media is clearly a theme that we see, and we're trying to train people to take advantage of that. And in my mind, it's sort of a no-excuses world we're entering. You know, in the old days, a musician could say, oh, the label didn't like me, they didn't promote my music. But these days, the label has been disintermediated. And so the opportunities are more for musicians to find ways to be discovered. And I was interested to – I checked before this show, and the number one employer of Berkeley alumni, any guesses?
Ooh, it's got to be somebody in Los Angeles.
Apple.
Wow.
Apple is the new music label. Apple's the largest employer of Berkeley alumni.
What about Carnival Cruise Lines? They're up there somewhere.
They didn't make the list.
Lee Pelton, I want to know how actors go viral.
Well, I'm not sure if actors do. We don't merely educate actors. We educate students in a variety of disciplines, and acting is one of those. You know, I think part of the issue here is that we tend to think of creativity as this pristine little thing that you put in a box. It's somehow special. It's isolated. It's elegant, and it's not part of the real world. Where in fact, creativity cuts across all disciplines, especially today. So at Emerson, our students will engage in creativity, in collaboration, in critical thinking, and in communication skills. And those four C's are really the roadmap to success. Whether you work at Apple, or whether you are in front of a camera or behind a camera, or whether you are in a marketing communications position, or whatever that might be.
Four C's, say them again.
Creativity, collaboration, critical thinking, communication skills.
This is Open Source with the presidents of the Berklee College of Music, Roger Brown, and of Emerson College, Lee Pelton. This is Terry Lynn Carrington, the jazz drummer, once a Berklee student, now an eminent Berklee teacher, leading a student ensemble.
Good. There's this chick, the harmony on like one of those places. Okay.
Where was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, either the first or the second. Just play it with the bass.
Roger, that's got to sound familiar.
That's Terry Lynn Carrington. My crowning achievement as president was flying out to California and begging her to come back and teach at Berklee, because I'm a drummer, and she's one of my favorite drummers of all time, and she's one of ours, so we love her. She's amazing.
I want to blue sky our way through the rest of this hour, talk about alternatives. Anybody want to start over in these institutions? Build it anew. You can sound like a radical at times, Lee Pelton.
So what do you mean by start over?
I've heard you say, let's get rid of tenure. Let's get rid of the departments. Let's get rid of rankings.
No, well, I didn't say get rid of tenure. What I did say is, quoting Woodrow Wilson, is that change at a college or university is like trying to move a cemetery. It's a really very hard thing to do. And it's particularly hard because there are all of these barriers, departmental barriers, sort of trust, distrust between the faculty and the administration. And I do believe that we need a flatter university, actually dismantle.
Flatter meaning?
Well, dismantle the academic departments and have fewer of them rather than more. And allow students to move with greater freedom from one department to another. I'm not saying get rid of the departments. Keep the disciplines, but get rid of, but have fewer departments. I think that the way architecture, we use architecture at our colleges is really not conducive to innovation. Our faculty and staff live in sort of silos, and what we need are spaces where students, faculty, and staff can come together in what I would call creative laboratories of some kind. I believe higher education privileges credentials over talent, and that we need a better job of identifying talent within our institutions, no matter who they are. Sometimes it could be a student, sometimes it could be a staff member. So these are some of the innovations that
Lee Pelton, I think it was you who told us that the two of you, as school presidents, take a walk around Walden Pond a couple times a year, summon the ghosts of Emerson and Thoreau, and tune the vision. I'd love to hear what you talk about, what you say.
Well, we spend most of our time talking about big ideas that inspire people to do good things.
Give us a start.
For instance, at Emerson, for instance, we have an entrepreneurship program. We have a business studies minor. We're in the process of developing a business major. And so in both of our institutions, as you heard earlier from one of the persons who spoke, that we need to educate our students about the business of business. We need to provide them with entrepreneurial opportunities. And so we've been talking about a way in which all of the sort of arts schools in the urban core might develop an accelerator program or a enterprise development program that we would all share in. So that would be one idea.
We're working on this thing at Berkeley called Berkeley Institute for Creative Entrepreneurship, Berkeley ICE. And we hired an alum named Panos Panay, who started a business that he sold for $15 million. He's a young man, fantastic guy. And what he's trying to help our students understand is that 90% of them are going to be entrepreneurs. Some are going to go work for Apple. But if you move to Brooklyn and start playing jazz, or you move to LA and start writing for TV, you're an entrepreneur, at least until you get established and someone hires you. So this notion of artist as entrepreneur resonates across our institutions and many others. We're collaborating with MIT, with Babson. There's a lot we can do with mass art and the museum school. So I think, you know, when Lee and I get together, we try to say, let's scrape off all the little details and all the alligators that nip at our ankles and think, what do we do to invent the most amazing higher education institutions on the planet and tear down some of those silos even between our institutions?
Artists are independent contractors. Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep is an independent contractor. She works on one project and then she goes to another project. And so having, you know, having some in-depth understanding of the business, how to network, how to leverage your acting to develop a production company or something like that. These are all important skills. And I know both of our institutions are very much engaged in imparting that that experience and knowledge.
We started a joint class recently about writing a musical together. So you got Emerson students and Berkeley students, you got actors, you got screenwriters, you got musicians. And at the end of the semester, they perform a musical that they've written. So they learn to collaborate. They learn to how you bring these disparate skills together. And they get output. And some of them are going to leave here as little entities and go out and create things in the bigger world.
On this matter of alternatives, we recorded a conversation earlier today with a graffiti artist. His name is Chris Ellis. He's known as Days. He's now 50 years old. He was wonderfully profiled in the Boston Globe this week. Days painted his first subway car when he was 14 years old. He's got work hanging now in the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan, also in the Brooklyn Museum. He comes from Brooklyn. What fascinated us was that Days tried art school, but knew exactly when it was time to move out, and he seized the moment.
Even though I went to an art high school, a lot of what I learned was on my own. So in that way, I'm kind of self-taught. For example, I was always going to museums as a kid. You know, I wanted to, you know, learn more about painting. So then I tried to figure out how to do certain things just by observation and by studying it. You know, it was great because when I walked out of there, I really felt like I was learning something that that I wasn't getting in a classroom situation. I saw people painting on the streets and, you know, I was interested in it. And then little by little, I started meeting people that were actually going out and painting. And, you know, I just realized it wasn't something random. There was a whole culture behind it. You know, I think that for some people, they need the structure of a school in order to excel. There is a point where you have to leave school and kind of get out into the real world and start to kind of gain experience. Mm.
So you never went into debt either, probably?
Nope. Debt is something, it's a, you know, kind of trap that America has set up for people. It's a real problem. It's like you're sinking in quicksand or something like that.
That was a man of unusual confidence, shall we say, as a teenager. But you must have them too. I've been waiting for somebody to say, get out of art school. Yeah. So many artists have. I mean, Matt Damon got out of Harvard. Miles Davis dropped out of Juilliard when he met Charlie Parker. I remember Branford Marsalis dropping out of Berkeley, yeah. Roger, when Art Blakey said, it's your time.
You know, I think we need to redefine our terms. When I came to Berkeley, I came out of with a traditional mindset. I'd gone to a liberal arts college and a fine graduate school. And we say drop out. But, you know, to be a great musician, you don't have to have a piece of parchment on your wall. You just need to be ready and able to deliver. And for some students, that's 2 semesters, and some it's 8 semesters, and some go to grad school. And I do think knowing when it's your time to go is a good thing. And if a student drops out of Berkeley, quote unquote, because they get the gig of a lifetime, and that happens, I say God bless you. And if you run out of steam and want to come back, we will welcome you back. And part of what we're trying to do is let students complete their degree through online education. So when they're on tour, instead of throwing TVs out of the window, they can go do online courses. But I think, you know, I think many of the things that used to look like maladies at Berkeley to me now look like assets.
Lee Pelton, it's probably not the president's job, but there must be deans at Emerson who've said to kids, to students, it's time to go.
Well, probably. I mean, I would hope that that would be a collaborative process between the student and the dean. You know, obviously the path to success varies with each individual, and they make these choices. 84% of our students actually finish in Emerson with an Emerson undergraduate degree in 6 years. And so that's right up there, well, actually above the national average. So
I've heard the line around Berkeley, if you stay to graduate, you're not good enough.
Esperanza Spalding, magna cum laude. Amy Heidemann of Carmen, magna cum laude. So we're also trying to dispel the myth that if you stay, there's something wrong with you. Because I do think it's helpful to have a college degree. And every year I get a call from some alum from 20 years ago who says, there's this job and I can't do it unless I have a degree and I'm 6 credits shy. So I think in on average, it's best to get a degree. But if Art Blakey calls you and you're Branford Marsalis, maybe the right answer is yes.
Our phone is 800-423-8255. Andrew is calling from Somerville.
Hi, yes.
Welcome, Andrew.
My name is Andrew. Hi. My name is Andrew Fish. I'm a painter in Somerville. I went to art school in the early 90s, and due to really heavy debt, I left the school. And I pursued my own education after that. You know, I felt like I was at a point in my life where I could either continue to go into debt or I could just go out and get work done. And so I chose to go out and get work done. But I didn't give up education completely, and I don't think anybody should. Education, you know, you can pursue it in experiential education, you can take classes, you can do, you know, residencies, all kinds of things. So I just want to make a point for experiential education and talk about how you can build a community around that as much as you can in a school.
Andrew, thank you.
Well, I mean,
Lee Pelton.
Andrew, thank you. I mean, that's wonderful that he's made that choice and has moved forward in a very successful way. Many of our students stay at Emerson because of the internships we provide, the opportunities for collaboration and experiential learning, and mostly because of the extraordinary networking that Emerson provides for our students and our alumni, really not only in this country but abroad as well. And when you're an independent contractor, and you're trying to make your way through the entertainment business, having a network is really the coin of the realm. And we do a very good job of providing our students.
Speak to the point that you are both running global institutions now. In little old Beantown, you're working in a global culture. There got to be pleasures in it and risks. But what are the lessons so far? There you are out and exploring China,
yeah. Roger. Well, if I were to say what are some of the other themes that Lee and I talk about, one is that the hegemony of the United States and the UK in global entertainment is going to disintegrate. The person who's had more YouTube views than anyone in history is Psy, the Korean, you know, Gangnam Style guy who spent 3 years at Berkeley, didn't finish.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a song in Korean by a 30-year-old guy. No record label in America would have touched it with a 10-foot pole, and it's had over 2 billion views. So the world is becoming more global. Our 101 countries of students represented at Berkeley are going to be collaborating from Brazil to Malaysia to Germany, and those kind of collaborations are going to be more and more important. And I personally am predicting that India is going to – it has all the conditions for a thriving music industry. Cultural diversity, a film industry, people urbanizing,
growing affluence, everything you saw in the United States in the last century.
Pakistan will be in contention on the music piece. I mean, they do a lot of the music for Bollywood. But here's another thing. In China today, the piano kids, mm-hmm. how many studying piano with a teacher? 40 million kids. What does Berklee bring to that hunger?
You know, China has historically been more of a classical music-oriented place based on the Soviet conservatory model, but we now have all these only children in China suddenly being exposed to great artists like Wang Lihom, a Berklee alum who sells out stadiums in every major city in China. And I'm predicting young people in China are going to say, we want to create our own music. And that China, I think our challenge is going to be, how do we handle the interest from China, which is why we formed relationships with three schools in Guangzhou, Shanghai, and Beijing, so that we can bring some of what we do at Berklee to China.
You were there. What did you learn?
You know, I learned a lot about the rate of change is so enormous. I was at Tiananmen Square, and I heard all these older people singing Maoist patriotic songs, and then I went to Shanghai Stadium, and I saw 55,000 screaming young girls at a Wang Lihom concert, and I thought, the pace of change here is so much faster than what we're used to. A lawyer told me that when he was going to law school, Tiananmen Square, you might see 10 cars in a day, and now, you know, it takes you a whole day to get through Tiananmen Square in a car.
And Lee Pelton, you're building out an Emerson campus in Los Angeles.
Yes, it's a study abroad program in a foreign country called Los Angeles. So for our undergraduates it's a bold visual statement of our presence in Los Angeles. We've been there for 30 years with a really robust internship program and so on. But like Roger, we also have a very global presence in Prague and we own a 14th century castle in the Netherlands. We have programs in China and so on. And as Roger suggests, that our students live in a global world, and the new media and the digital world that we live in has democratized that. So it's easy, it's more accessible, and it's the capacity to create has been increased exponentially in the last decade or so.
Roger, what was the lesson of Spain for Berklee?
Well, for me, in my own personal experience, getting out of a small town in Georgia and going to study in Italy and Greece changed my life. And I think too many North American students don't get out of here, and they don't understand what's going on in the rest of the world. If they're going to be successful, they need to have a global perspective. So like Emerson, it's a study abroad program for us. We actually have 6 Emerson students studying there right now. And I was told they're incredibly happy because I said, you better take care of those Emerson kids. I want them to come back and sing our praises. So, you know, it's a chance for those students to get out of Dodge and see what's happening in a country that's different enough, but similar enough that it's not overwhelming to them. And Spain, of course, is this great intersection of the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe.
Amen. Roger Brown and Lee Pelton, thank you. Thanks also to Marianne Leone, Chris Cooper, and the artist Days. We're going out on Terry Lynn Carrington's student ensemble at Berklee. There's lots more on our website, including an amazing interactive chart that illustrates what college is actually worth nowadays, and some useful advice for the aspiring artist from lots of familiar big names in lights. Next week, the third in our series of programs about higher ed, we're going to hack our way to a better way, call it New You, and help us work it through at radioopensource.org. Our program was produced by Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, Matt Ellison, and our engineer George Hicks, artists, every one of them. Mary McGrath is our executive rock star. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time, please, for Open Source.